ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Beloved listeners, I want to read you a few words written to Henry James, or about Henry James, by Somerset Maugham. He did not live, he observed life from a window, and too often was inclined to content himself with no more than what his friends told him they saw when they looked out of a window. But what can you know of life unless you have lived it? Okay, the words were intended to mock James, but Maugham might also have been warning us against the perils of observing life through our modern-day window, the screen. My guest thinks that what we lonely, screen-addicted 21st century humans really crave is connection, effectively real eyeball-to-eyeball stuff. Social psychologist, friend of mine and of the program for many decades, and a fellow octogenarian, Hugh McKay has spent his lifetime listening intensely to his fellow Australians. Hence his new book is a testament to that. The Way We Are, Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening. And he joins me on the Little Wireless program. Welcome back, Hugh.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's an enormous pleasure to be here and to catch you in the nick of time.
Yes, that's an ironic remark. Now, you make the point that historically, humans have passed on knowledge orally. Why was the shift to visual mediums like print and ultimately screens so important?
It was important. Well, first of all, it was important for the masses to get access to the printed word, because until then there was an elite group, particularly of the priesthood or of other cultural elites, academics, etc., who had access to all of this material and relayed what they wanted to orally to the masses. So the invention of the printing press really was a revolution comparable with the invention of the internet or the invention of the smartphone. I mean, we think of it now as something that's just part of life. But of course, it began a revolution, and this happens with virtually every bit of technology that's invented. It began a revolution, the consequences of which we couldn't have anticipated 400 years ago, or perhaps even didn't even realize 100 years ago. Namely, that as more and more people learned to read and write, and the written word came to adopt a kind of superior status, this would have the effect of separating the person from the message. It would have the weird effect of us conditioning ourselves to thinking that the meaning is in the words, that all you need is to read what's on the page and not have any kind of contact with the person who authored those words. Now, that's just such an embedded part of our culture, we accept it. But it's part of a larger picture, Philip, which is that we humans who thrive on what you described as eyeballs, you know, eye contact with each other, absolute face-to-face interaction with each other, we have always privileged mediated information, whether they're rock carvings or books, or more recently, text messages or posts on Snapchat or Instagram and so on. It's a weird thing that contradicts the essence of our nature, our need of communication directly with each other.
I have to thank you for reminding me about that remarkable fellow, Marshall McLuhan, famous for The Medium is the Message. He talks about typographic man.
Yes.
Tell me about typographic man.
Well, you and I are typographic men, and there are plenty of typographic men and women listening to us, I'm sure. That is, people who were raised on a diet of print and who learned to respect the printed word above the spoken word, but were therefore conditioned by the form. And of course, this was McLuhan's brilliant insight, that the form of the medium had a more profound effect on us than the content of the medium. So we learned to read by going left to right along the line, one word after the other, then down to the next line, etc., to an intensely logical, rational, sequential, linear way of digesting information. And the same with writing. I mean, you don't get far if you just sprinkle a few words randomly across a page or if you try to read that way. So his point was, spend your formative years becoming a slave to the printed word, and that will affect your way of seeing the world. You will look for logical patterns. You'll assume dangerously and misguidedly that humans are rational creatures because being typographic people, being conditioned by the medium, we come to think of ourselves in that way.
When you and I were young, television arrives. Did that have a profound impact on our perceptions?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, again, that was a great insight of McLuhan's. He pointed out, when he said the medium is the message, he said it doesn't really matter whether you're watching Westerns or crime drama or news and current affairs or romance or horror. What's really happening is the medium itself is changing your view of the world. And of course, it was doing that in the case of television by bringing back some of the features of the pre-print culture. It was an audio-visual. I mean, radio had started that job, an audio culture. Radio survives and thrives because it's part of our long-term oral culture. Even though we're not face-to-face and we're not making eye contact with our listeners, this is absolutely what we do in an oral culture. We talk to each other. But television gave us that with pictures. But of course, it also prepared us.
The devil's tool, Hugh. I think the world went down the gurgler at that point.
Well, we started to, I mean, the best you could say of it was that it, for a while, it acted like a kind of social campfire where people would sit around it every night, actually in groups. I mean, in the early days, people would invite their neighbours in to watch television, you know, come and watch.
Or you'd stand on the footpath and press your nose on a window watch them in a retailer.
That's right. But it was conditioning us to a new perception, which was something that we thought of as reality but was in two dimensions on a flat screen.
But it's lost its predominance these days to more atomized digital forms.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the big contributors to what I think one of the central themes of this book, which is we've become more atomized, we've become more fragmented. That's one of the many, many contributors to that, is that the media landscape has become more fragmented, that there is not nearly as much shared media experience as there used to be.
In a sense, we were all at least on the same page. It was the good side, the cohesive side of mass media.
Yeah, it was. And the more limited the media, the more that was true. But as a kind of picture, as a little symptom of the erosion of social cohesion and the rise of this dangerous state we're in at the moment of social fragmentation, one little symptom of it is, or contributing cause, in fact, is the splintered media landscape, no question.
Now, early in your book, you ask us to imagine contemporary Australia as a vast social science laboratory. Yeah. To borrow from Pauline Hanson, please explain.
Well, let's go back. Well, we've known each other. I was working it out just before we came on air. We've known each other for about 50 years. Now, that's been a most extraordinary period in Australia's social evolution. Let's imagine when we first met, I visited you in your office in Melbourne at the time. Let's imagine we'd sat down and we had some sense of our own supreme power. And I said, listen, Philip, let's run an experiment with this mob. Let's take Australia and do things to it and see what happens. And here's some of the things we'll do. We'll shrink their households. We'll try and get them to live in smaller and smaller households until we reach the point where maybe even as many as 25% of households will contain just one person, where more than 50% of households will contain one or two people. Let's see what that does. Let's see if we can bust up more of their marriages. They cling to each other for too long. Our goal might be somewhere between 35 and 40% of marriages will end in divorce. Let's do that. Let's get the birth rate through the floor. It's too high. Let's have fewer kids. Kids are a kind of social lubricant. Let's minimize that social lubricant. Hey, here's another thing we can do. Let's get them to move more often. Let's get them to move house, say, once every 6 years on average. And let's give them all cars so they become more mobile. So instead of stopping and chatting to each other on footpaths, they wave at their neighbours' cars.
And let's also increase secularisation.
Yep, let's increase secularisation. Let's remove those faith communities that people used to congregate in. Here's another one we could do. Let's make them run faster than ever. Let's make them busier than ever so they haven't got time for social connections. And here's one, you'll just laugh when I suggest this, but let's invent some technology that's so seductive, that's so attractive, that they'll sacrifice face-to-face time in favour of screen-based contact. Now, let's do all that and let's see what happens. I'll make a prediction, Philip. I reckon 50 years from now, there'll be epidemics of mental illness. You know, these are members of the human species. These are people who need each other. They're hopeless in isolation. They need groups and communities to give them that sense of belonging that's completely fundamental to human health and happiness. We know all that. So this experiment we're going to do, we know what it'll do. It'll produce epidemics of loneliness and anxiety and depression. In fact, I think I could predict by the time we get to, say, somewhere like 2024, the number one public health issue in Australia, if we do all these things we're planning, the number one public health issue in Australia will be social isolation, not obesity. They'll go through a period of obesity being the number one public health issue, but they'll get to the point where all of these changes will take effect and social isolation.
And that can lead to the outcomes like suicide.
Absolutely.
You also suggest that we can know too much in this so-called information age.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, it's fashionable to call it the information age. I challenge that in the book. I think we should call it the age of opinion because I think it is possible to know too much in the sense of just acquiring too much data, too much information, which is not relevant to the way we lead our lives. It's not going to have any impact on our personal relationships, but we try to, we're just drowning in it.
I have a favourite aphorism, which is that data isn't information. Information is knowledge and knowledge isn't wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's right. T.S. Eliot came up with something like that at first and then it was modified. And that's right. Now we understand about data. It's certainly not the same thing as knowledge. So how do we deal with it? And this, I think, is a very interesting characteristic of the present moment, which is we deal with it by jumping to instant opinions. We make instant judgments, you know, love it, hate it. Oh, I give it 4 stars, you know, 50%. Brilliant, hopeless, can't see the point of it, wonderful. We're supposed to have opinions. You know, how do you compare Taylor Swift and Beyonce? You know, you better have an opinion about this because you're expected to have an opinion about everything in this age of opinion, so-called age of information age. I think it is dangerous for us because it's taking away from us the time we would normally have spent reflecting, interpreting, trying to make sense of what we're hearing. And then responding to it. There's no time for processing.
Hugh, you're no Luddite, and you can't deny the internet has been, well, transformative in some positive ways.
Of course, that's right. And I use it the same as you do and we all do. It has created the possibility of connection, particularly between people who do know each other but can't get together for some reason. I mean, the information technology revolution, and specifically the internet and most specifically the smartphone, the promise was you'll be more connected than ever. And that's true. What they neglected to mention was it'll be easier than ever for you to stay apart. And we've now got a strange phenomenon, not just here, around the Western world, well, around the world in general, but certainly we've got it in Australia, this phenomenon of people who are connected but lonely. And in fact, the 18 to 25-year-olds, you know, this I think is something we wouldn't have predicted 50 years ago when we were playing God with society, that the 18 to 25-year-olds in our community are the loneliest age cohort in Australian society. But they are also, of course, the most connected. So, of course, the internet has brought untold blessings, benefits. It's efficient, it's clever, it's brilliant.
Well, it gave us movements like Me Too and revolutions like the Arab Spring.
Yes, absolutely. That's all good. And I acknowledge all the many, many benefits that it's brought to us. But it's the same as any other bit of technology that we've just got to remember that it's our servant. A very popular complaint now is, oh, we seem to have lost our shared values. We seem to have lost our sense of morality. Well, yes. And why would that be? Well, the moral sense is a social sense. We develop our sense of right and wrong by negotiating our way through society, by figuring out how to deal with people we don't like and all that sort of stuff. And we constantly refresh our moral sense. We keep the moral compass working by having to continue with this social negotiation that's inherent to our species. Now, when we're sacrificing too much of that time in favor of screen time, then we are at risk of dulling our own moral clarity. I mean, I actually think one of the reasons why in social media there is so much abuse, so much bullying, so much reckless, nasty behavior is that people who are the heaviest users are not just a bit socially deprived, but they may be somewhat morally diminished by the fact that they haven't been freshening up their moral sense by having enough contact. I remember just a few days ago, another broadcaster, in fact, said to me, we receive at the station some texts from listeners that are so vile, we know they would never say that stuff to us face to face.
Well, you're certainly right. These are days when maniacal conspiracy theories have flourished in a way that was never feasible or possible before.
That's right. I mean, that's the dark side of the Me Too movement, for example. As you say, here is a technology that has allowed a global revolution to occur for good, but it's also it's also cast shadows, and there's a lot of nasty people or people with nasty impulses lurking in those shadows.
Tell me about the Dunning-Kruger effect.
Yes. This is lovely. I'm sure many of our listeners are aware of this, or even if they don't know it by that name, they know they'll recognize it in themselves or each other, which is that people with the least qualification to hold an opinion are most likely to cling to that opinion. That the more ignorant we are, the more confident we are of the things we claim to know. Bertrand Russell, I can't remember the exact words, but he made this point a long time ago where he said the problem with the world is that wise people are so full of doubt and foolish people are so full of confidence.
One of the great quotes of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. So Dunning-Kruger did some research in which they demonstrated that people with the least qualifications to hold particular opinions hold them more ferociously than those who are well equipped to hold those opinions and are more likely to experience doubt simply because they are more thoughtful, less arrogant about the opinions they hold.
So what fake wisdom do we mostly accept as truth here in Australia, Hugh?
Yeah, fake wisdom. I had a lot of fun with this chapter, even though I'm sure I'll have trodden on some toes. But it is odd how we just accept things as part of our folklore as if they're true. I mean, one of the most common ones, which I was hearing someone on radio talking about just a couple of days ago, the proposition that in order to change someone's behaviour, you must first change their minds. Now, that is simply unproven. That is simply fake wisdom. The truth is that people's attitudes are mainly the result of their behaviour, of what they do, of their experience. If you want to change someone's behaviour, change their behaviour. Do something to the situation they're in, something to their circumstances, something to their social or physical context that will affect their behaviour. I mean, if you're a marketing person, drop the price or improve the product or change the pack. That'll change people's behaviour. Don't think you've got to change their minds. Don't think if your teenage son or daughter is leaving that dirty clothes all over the bedroom floor that you've got to change their attitudes. No, you've got to change the system so they change their behaviour.
Tell me briefly about Jerome Kagan from Harvard.
Kagan is famous for his research, which demonstrated that another piece of fake wisdom is fake, namely that humans thrive on stability. What Kagan demonstrated is that we thrive on change, that we need the challenge of new information, new experience. And he points to our behaviour as infants, that if you watch a very young child, what they're constantly wanting is new experience. They're constantly looking for new stuff that they can react to. And the truth about us is, although we say, oh, why can't everything stay the same? Why do things have to change so much? The truth is that we are stimulated, we're kept alive, we're illuminated by having to deal with all these changes. These challenges that crash into our lives, they're not welcome necessarily when they happen, but they almost always have the effect of enlivening us and keeping us more alert, keeping us more engaged. That's even true, of course, in the case of natural disasters like floods and fires and COVID, awful things that happen to us, but they enliven us. They bring out the best in us.
Another of your fake wisdom is the idea that mass media is more powerful than we think. I take some comfort in that.
Mm. Yeah, this is often when I talk about these things, and this has been going on for decades. People will often say, "But don't you think the media are to blame if we're talking about some social problem, social issue?" Well, no. We tend to use the media to reinforce our existing prejudices, our existing point of view. Sure, we sometimes use the media in an open-minded way to acquire new information. What's the latest? What's actually happening in Gaza today, for example? But more typically, we use the media to reinforce our existing point of view or just to provide us with some distraction entertainment, light entertainment, as they used to call it at the ABC in the old days. People say, oh, the Murdoch press. The Murdoch press has a terrible effect on Australian attitudes, controls the outcome of elections, etc. Well, no, it doesn't. I mean, you only have to go back to the most recent federal election to see that the Murdoch press was advocating a result that was the opposite of what we got. And that's often the case. So I think we do ourselves an enormous disservice when we assume, and parents in particular, do themselves an enormous disservice when they assume that the media are more powerful than they are. We have much more potential influence on each other and especially on our kids than the media do. The media are there I mean, they're a pastime most of the time. We don't say chess or Scrabble, you know, is destroying the world. Back to Marshall McLuhan, it's not so much the content of the media, it's the time we spend being distracted by the media, but it's not, for most of us, so serious that we absorb. I mean, imagine if we did actually absorb everything we heard and took it as gospel and were changed by it, we'd be changing our minds 10 times a day. Our heads would be spinning.
The great issues at the moment, one of them you've mentioned is Gaza, the other is misogyny. Mm. And do you make the point that misogyny has a paradox at its heart?
It does indeed. And the paradox is that it's as much about male self-loathing as it is about hatred of women. Now, this is not much consolation to the women who are being hated, but I think when we start to try and address the problem of misogyny, and it's been in decline, but there's still a misogynistic rump in our society who haven't got that there's been a gender revolution, I think it is important to realize that this is men hating themselves and projecting that hatred onto women. What is it that they're hating about themselves? Very often, it's that they're deeply uncomfortable with the feminine side of their own nature. We are all, as you know, we are all located on a gender spectrum. We have biological sex, that's one thing, but we're located on a gender spectrum. And as part of the gender revolution, we're only now beginning to realize that it wasn't just about equality between men and women. It was also about acknowledging and embracing and offering equality to people who are non-binary, people who are transgender, people who acknowledge in themselves feminine aspects of their nature. But men of a certain kind, men who've been resistant to this gender or even resistant to the idea of the gender spectrum, are very uncomfortable with any sign of the feminine in themselves. And women kind of remind them of that. And so this is an absurd response. They become so obsessed with resisting the feminine in themselves and asserting some extreme form of masculinity that makes them obsessed about women, women as the other. And of course, what they're really concerned about is the otherness within their own nature.
Do you think the Me Too movement has been successful in bringing to the fore discussions about sexual predation?
Absolutely. I think it's in the same way as I'd say, if you said to me over the 60 years plus of my research career, what is the biggest single change in Australian society? Well, there are two. One we've already talked about, we've become more socially fragmented and that's dangerous. But the other one, the big, big one is the gender revolution that we have. I mean, if you and I were to ruminate and reflect on the place of women in the 1950s, our listeners would be horrified. I mean, we've come a million miles and the gender revolution that really began, the second wave revolution that began in the 70s, has been utterly transformative, radically transformative, and we need to remember how far we've come. Yes, we still have some way to go. But in the same way as I think the Me Too movement was absolutely, it was radical, it was courageous, its aims were noble, and its impact has been good. And we, as with the feminist revolution, so with the Me Too revolution, I sound a little warning in the book. Let's be careful that we don't go too far. Let's make sure that the revolutionaries don't take that short journey towards becoming Puritans.
In the last 200,000 years, Homo sapiens became the only human species on the planet. And we've been around for much of that time, Hugh. So tell us... What gave us this edge over the other four species?
Yeah, this is a lovely, lovely story, which has really just emerged quite recently from the work of a group of British and German archaeologists worrying away at that and doing new research, worrying away at that puzzle that you just defined. How come? I mean, there used to be five species of humans. There was Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, Neanderthals, a couple of others I can't recall at the moment. 42,000 years ago, just before we were born, 42,000 years ago, there was a cataclysmic climatic event that wiped out four of the five species. Why did Homo sapiens alone survive? Well, these archaeologists have now found evidence in the archaeological record that they believe explains it. And it was not Charles Darwin, survival of the fittest. It was not that they had bigger brains or made better tools or did superior rock carvings, because the other species all did that stuff too. What they've concluded is that Homo sapiens alone among the five species had figured out how to form close-knit, mutually supportive, caring, compassionate communities where we cared for the sick and the injured. It's in the archaeological record. So they talk about survival of the kindest, which I've adopted as the heading for one of the chapters in the new book.
My guest has been a distinguished example of the Homo sapien, and that's social psychologist Hugh McKay. And his new book is called The Way We Are, Lessons from a Lifetime of Listening, published by Allen and Unwin. And thanks for coming on, Hugh.
Great pleasure. Thanks, Philip.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.